Hello to all you boys next door, mums and dads, new weds and nearly deads, and welcome to Dangerous Amusements, a podcast where we talk about the music of Elvis Costello. I'm Stu Arrowsmith, and in each episode I'll be joined by a special guest to chat all things Elvis, and I'll be asking them to help me compile the ultimate Elvis Costello playlist. Now remember, don't make any sudden movements, because these are Dangerous Amusements. My guest on this episode is a musician, singer, songwriter, someone who's recorded and toured with Elvis Costello. Welcome to Dangerous Amusements, Ian Prowse.
Hiya, mate.
How are you?
I'm good, very good.
Good. Listen, thanks for doing this and giving up a bit of time. Yeah. I know you've got the school run, and I believe you're back in the studio as well. You're working on some new material.
Yeah, we have. We've laid down the basics for 7 new songs. It'll be the follow-up to Here I Lie, our 2019 album. And as any musician will tell you, there's nothing as exciting as doing new music, and feeling it develop, you know, writing new lyrics and coming up with new tunes. And and when they start to sound good, it's the best bit of the job.
Yeah. Any thoughts on when we might get to hear some
of that? Oh, it could be 6 months, could be 12 months, could be 18 months. It won't come out until it's absolutely as good as it could be and a worthy follow-up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
When it's right.
Yeah.
Well, you started this year before everything kind of went to shit, if we can say that. You started the year on the road with Elvis. And I was at the opening night at the Liverpool Olympia. It was a great night, great gig. You and the band were great, and then Elvis and the Impostors. And the atmosphere was terrific as well. And every review that I've read says that the rest of the tour carried on very much in the same vein.
Yeah. To kick off with, it was just such a... an honour and so exciting to get the tour, you know. And I think I spent 2 weeks before we even the first day just dreaming about it. It was coming into every aspect of my world, unconscious and conscious days. And to start off in Liverpool was always going to be super exciting because it was standing venue in that old arena, you know, where they used to have all the circus animals. And I know Elvis was super excited because it was on his bus route. So he loved that. I think that's one of the reasons he chose it. And it couldn't have gone any better the opening night, for us kicking off the whole thing. And then he just took the bloody roof off.
He really did. I think you're right about the standing venue because the atmosphere was cracking in there as well. It looked like a few times Elvis was taking the earpiece out so he could hear the crowd response without any filter. Yeah.
It was astounding, and it was a proper Liverpool Friday night out. You know what I mean? When we got up to the venue, there was already hundreds of people milling around, you know, kind of spilling out onto the road, and people shouting at each other, and it was just exciting. It felt like, you know, it felt like the old days to a certain degree. And then, you know, we knew we had to be the first people on the stage. So, and I get nervous anyway.
Right.
It's like taking your driving test every time you walk on stage for me. And it was just one of those evenings. You know, there's so many bits and pieces to putting on a show. Well, for him as well, you know, with the big video screens, and he had the great backing singers. There's so many moving parts, you know, you could sit there worrying about them all, but it just fired off so fantastically. And of course the crowd, you know what I mean? This is, I always say to him when I see him, welcome home, you know, and he definitely feels that as well.
It must be a buzz to open for him, to do your set and then to get to sit back and watch him.
Well, it was kind of like, I mean, I've done, you know, lots and lots of tours of the country, but I don't think I've ever done a tour ever whereby the main act has been one of my musical heroes as well, apart from as a friend. I mean, you know, we toured with the Pogues, and God, I love the Pogues, and we did Delamitri and the Wonder stuff and lots of other bands. But, you know, when I was 12, 13, 14, you know, Elvis Costello, The Jam and The Clash and The Stranglers.
Right.
These are why I'm sat here today talking to you, you know.
Yeah.
So to get the opportunity then to go and do a full UK tour with him to play was my first thrill that we were doing. And then, of course, it dawns on you that as soon as you finish, you can go out and watch him, which I did every night, you know. And that was just fantastic. And then, of course, then you get paid on top of it. It's bizarre. I always it always dawns on me last that I'm getting paid, and that's like an extra. Oh wow, that's cool and all. So yeah, and of course I'd get to see what the set list was, and again that's just like cosmic.
Yeah.
You know, for somebody like me, you know, where I came into to playing music, it was amazing.
Yeah. Well, he's such a compelling live performer, isn't he? Because he doesn't treat his songs as sacrosanct. He's,
no.
He's looking for ways to reinterpret them, whether it's a new arrangement, new lyrics maybe as well. So it's always a little bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was kind of like, for the first night that I watched him, he was kind of out there. It felt like he was on his own. The two girls were way back. Davey on the bass was back, the drums were back, and then Stevie's off to the right. So he's kind of on his own, you know.
Mm.
And I was like, God, he's like facing this alone.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he just goes at him like a bull at a gate, and drags us all with him. And that is where, you know, it's where I came in as a young boy and as a non-musician. There was no musicians in my family or no instruments lying around the house when I'm, you know, 14 and I hear some of those songs. It's the conviction.
Yeah.
And his conviction is exactly the same to this day. So, you know, he never phones it in.
No. What were the first records of his that you got into?
Oh, I would be just like anybody else. So it would be 78, I reckon. And it felt like I would have been 13 then, you know. And it felt like there was this conveyor belt, which punk and new wave, that revolution, there was a constant. Every week or every month there'd be a new act.
Mm.
You know, we'd had The Clash and The Pistols. And then, you know, The Jam had come along and The Stranglers. And then there's like Elvis Costello, who's this guy? You know, Ian Dury. And then the American ones, Blondie, Talking Heads, Ramones. And then Squeeze, you know, and even like The Police. And it just seemed to be so many great bands. Mm. And I remember the first song of his I ever heard would probably have been something like Watching the Detectives. It comes along and it's... And it kind of sticks out like a sore thumb because of the style of the music that him and the Attractions were making, you know, with the that particular organ sound. I don't know if it was a Vox Continental or a Farfisa or whatever it was, you know, it was them, wasn't it?
Mm.
And his vocal delivery and then of course the way he looked, you know, it was like sort of punk rock Buddy Holly something going on. But and then there was this lyrical machine gun, you know. So I think I would have heard that, but then I think the first track that I just went, oh Jesus, what's this, is Chelsea, because the way it was played, the way it came out the radio, you just went out and bought it, and that was it. You know, you're on board the ship then, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, and then you kind of, you're open to what had gone before and what came, you know, afterwards when he had like bigger hits. So that would have been when my cement was wet with his music. That was it. I was in. And it was part of a... It wouldn't have been like this for him, but it was certainly for me. It was part of a set, of a series of great bands.
The golden period.
You know. The Pretenders, you know. I remember them coming out and going, when's it ever going to end, this conveyor? And of course it didn't, because we went into, like, you know, The Specials and Two Tone, and then it was Echo and the Bunnymen and post-punk, and it was fabulous that it changed every 6 months.
Mm. And is that shaping your own musical adventures as you're starting to get into music yourself before Pelé, and then once you get going?
Yeah, I still consider myself a real year zero kid, because there was no inclination to play a musical instrument. As I say, we had no musicians in the family. There was no things lying around the house, you know. There was no piano in the house or guitars or anything. Didn't know anybody in my estate in Ellesmereport that played guitar or music. It was, and nobody would ever walk around the estate with a guitar, because it just would have been, you know, just poncy. Would have been, and certainly nobody would have proclaimed for themselves to be an artist or a songwriter. It was just a place of factories and just solid working class existence. You know, both my mum and dad both worked in a factory on a production line, unskilled for 40 odd years each. So anything outside of that was just so glamorous, we couldn't go near it. And then all of a sudden comes along all of these artists. Paul Weller would have been the first one for me, because I went to see The Jam first at Liverpool Empire, and he seemed to be speaking about my world, you know, that I was from. The conviction and the anger just appealed to me immediately, went straight in. So that was me becoming part of the whole punk and new wave. This is my generation. This is our statement, which every generation needs to have. And this was it. And to this day, I'm still like so thrilled that I got to come of age in that period.
Yeah.
Because it's still, you know, the Undertones, Stiff Little Fingers. It's still an amazing period of music, you know. And some of the records you hear, they're amazing records. You know, and then of course, there he was, Elvis Costello. Rumoured that he was a local lad as well, you know, which always helps.
Yeah.
And it had such personality to it, didn't it? You know what I mean? You can see why it broke through. You can see why some of the others, you know, maybe fell to the wayside or didn't quite go on to do what they should have done. What he was doing, what the lads in the band were doing, was stuffed with personality. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tell you what, let's turn to our playlist. People can find our playlist by looking for Dangerous Amusements on Spotify. Each guest on the podcast has added 5 Costello songs to the playlist.
Yeah.
One from the 1970s, one from the 80s, one from the 90s, one from the noughties, and one from 2010 onwards. So while we're talking 1970s, let's just talk about your choice, and you've already mentioned it. I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea.
Yeah. Lyrically, again, you know, it's like such an unusual thing. And the way the song starts with the drums and then the band kicking with that great riff, and he's just like, you know, like a Gatling gun over the top, the way he was delivering the lyrics. Oh, I know it does not move me, even though I see the movie. I don't want to check your pulse. I don't want nobody else. I don't want to go to Chelsea. Who wouldn't be seduced by that type of music as a young man, you know? And it felt like young people's music. I remember going to see The Jam, and I think it was at Mountford Hall the second time I seen them. There was nobody in there over 18. It was youth music, you know, and I had the similar feeling about this music, what Elvis was making. I mean, where he'd come from, he might not see himself as part of that. But me, as the kid, you know, at the other end of the process of making music, and it being sold in the music industry, it was very much part of that, you know. And it just struck home, and whatever energy that I got off these artists at that time, Joe Strummer, you know, Jesus, how could you not, you know, want to emulate somebody who looked like they were going to die with at the end of every line they delivered, you know, and you couldn't barely understand what Joe was singing as well, you know.
But you'd join them on the barricades.
Yeah, you really would. And so therefore, whatever energy that I got off all those fellas at that point, I still consider the energy which I run on today as an artist myself, in that the key word would be conviction, you know, that they appeared to be, for the first time, to me, to be absolutely, utterly serious in what they were saying, what they were trying to say, and they were delivering it with such conviction that, you know, you got the feeling they weren't in it just to be famous or attract girls or make money, that they wanted to change the world or comment upon the world that they were in, you know. And the you know, there's an old tradition of that, which I'm, you know, Elvis would have been, you know, obviously very familiar with, but I wasn't, you know. I didn't know anything about Bob Dylan. I didn't know anything about Woody Guthrie or Lead Belly or any of these guys. So this was all brand spanking new to me, you know. That was something I'd have to go back to. So if you see it for the first time, then it's just incredibly attractive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, this one, released as a single in March 78, reaches number 16 in the UK chart and then obviously appears on this year's Model. And you were talking about the sound of it, and I've read Elvis say that the band would often bring their variations of other songs to a recording, but then by the time you've mixed all those different elements together, it becomes something new.
Yeah.
So I think this one, he said the guitar riff from a Pioneers record, and Pete Thomas's drums from the start of...
It's brilliant.
And then the drums from Fire, Mitch Mitchell, on Jimi Hendrix's...
See, thing. I wouldn't know any of that.
But then once you put it in the blender, it becomes Elvis and the Attractions, doesn't it?
Well, on Oliver's Army, the whole ABBA descending piano riff, it just wouldn't have occurred to me. And I don't care. There's a little bit of Born to Run on there as well on that song. And it doesn't matter. Mm. You know, the way that songwriting often works is you do kind of co-opt bits of other songs, but it's how you do it. If you do it honestly and with integrity, it just doesn't bloody matter that there might be fragments. Mm. And that's what makes for great music, you know, is... and keeps music alive for me is mongrel music, hybrids of different styles.
Yeah.
You know, when it becomes just pure, I think it can wither on the vine. But their records, with what the lads were throwing in, you know, it was fabulous.
Yeah. You mentioned Born to Run, and I know Springsteen's another big hero of yours.
Yeah.
I remember seeing you 8-9 years ago now. I think it was at the Empire, and you joined Elvis and the Imposters for Peace, Love and Understanding.
Yeah.
And the band went into Rosalita towards the end. Yeah. And I know you've named your daughter after that Springsteen song as well. So for all those different elements coming together, that must have been a great moment for you up there.
Yeah. That's a testimony to his incredible generosity towards me down the years. And you know, the Empire, Liverpool Empire, is the first gig I ever went to. Saw the Jam, but I think it was the last time the Beatles ever played in Liverpool was at the Empire.
Okay.
So the Empire has, you know, immense kudos for anybody of our generation.
It's part of growing up around here, isn't it? To go to a show,
it's a real, you know, and the first pantomime I ever went to was at the Empire when you're like five or something. So he called me up. I think we did. Ferry Across the Mersey.
That's right. Yeah. It was the it was on Spinning Wheel Tour.
That's
wasn't
right.
It?
Yeah, Spinning Wheel Tour. And he was like, I'd seen him in the daytime at the sound check. He goes, "I'll get you up." Oh, fantastic! Wow, that's great. Yeah. And then at the end, I got up again, and we did all those bits, and he went into a bit of Rosalita, which is amazing because Rosie had just been born. But I think he wanted to get me in one of the cages as well.
Yeah.
But I somehow evaded that.
Well, I was saying to Mark Billingham on the last episode, on those shows, I really fancied going up and spinning the wheel, and I quite fancied being taken by the hand by the mysterious Josephine. But out of the corner of my eye, I could see the go-go cage, and I thought, I'll probably stay here.
It was suggested. It was suggested, but he had a look on his face as if to say, you don't really have to do that. But I would have.
Couple of
I've done
later.
Much worse things after a few drinks, I'll tell you.
On a more serious one, just to go off at a slight tangent, I think one of my absolute favourite songs of yours is one that you wrote for your daughter as well, Here I Lie, which I just think is such a gorgeous song.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's another great thing about Elvis and Bruce, I count them both together in this bit, is there been their ability to still write really good and songs that hit home at this point in their lives. Mm. So when we did the Here I Lie album and I wrote that song, I was really, it was a really pleasing because, you know, so many artists, they were just good for a burst at some point. But if you can keep it going as a songwriter and stay, you know, relevant to yourself and come up with really good songs after you've already been doing it for 30, 40 years. That's hard to do. So when you do it, it's a relief and a thrill, you know. So,
That line of, I passed you on the stairs, I always think that's a bit of a lump in the throat.
Oh, throat, yeah. Line, isn't it? Well, it's kind of, it's a strange song as well, in that it's kind of, it's partly supposed to be functional, because I assume she will use it for the instructions that are within the song when I'm long gone. Mm. You know, and I sometimes think about how will I feel for her, because it will have always been there while I'm here, and then when I'm not here, the song actually then comes into its own as why I've written it for her. And I just hope that it brings her some, you know, some really lovely feelings. And, you know, yeah.
Okay. Well, from one extreme emotion to another, we'll go to your next song choice on the playlist. This was your 1980s song choice.
Okay.
Very different place from Blood and Chocolate, I Want You.
I mean, God, the 80s again. It could have been, last few days, I've been looking through all of them. And it could have been any song off Blood and Chocolate.
Listen, I've ruined a few people's lives over the last few weeks, making them narrow the 80s down to one Elvis song.
Absolutely. There's so many great songs. And, you know, before I came out today, I was listening to Good Year for the Roses. Mm. Well, I know it's his cover, but to me, it's his and his delivery. It's just one of his songs. And it's one of the greatest songs ever recorded. Mm. Great recordings as well. As my producer Tony Kiley always says, there's a difference between good songs and great records.
Yeah.
You know, The Clash, only in, and you know, obviously this is just my opinion, they only started to make great records when the drummer joined, Tophead. Mm. You know, Hedden joined. He was the final piece of the jigsaw where the records became great, you know. And for a lot of these Elvis tracks, you know, the great records, and that Good Year for the Roses. So I was kind of like, should I go for that? But then I put Blood and Chocolate on, and I love the whole album. Yeah. You know, it feels to me a little bit like his Nebraska, but obviously, you know, electric drums, but in its, I know they recorded it all together on the floor. There's is it Uncomplicated? The first track, just weird noises coming in and out. The horse count in the arithmetic.
Yeah.
I love that. You know, and then you know, Tokyo Storm Warning just goes on and on and on, but it's relentlessly fabulous. You know, and that's kind of him doing his Dylan thing, I suppose. Yeah. By the time you get to the end of the record, and every single song is knockout for me, you know, every single one, then this song comes on the end, which is so brave and so honest. Mm. It reminds me of Lennon's Plastic Ono Band album, where, you know, he's, again, it's so honest, and he's like, he's cut the veins and he's bled onto the record.
There's no imagery, it's just stress.
Dylan-esque poetry, you know, maybe which would be wonderful and lyrical and you know, maybe even illuminate the points he's trying to get to. There's none of that. It's cut straight to the point on John's record, and I get the same feeling in this. In I Want You, I love the way there's a kind of a pre-song. It's kind of like sets it up, and then all of a sudden there's this jarring chord that comes in, and then the song in earnest begins.
I want you. You had your fun. You don't get well no more. I want you. Your fingernails go dragging down the wall. Be careful, darling, you might fall.
As the song, you know, unfolds, I know people have said that it's a little bit sinister. I've heard that said about it. But I actually feel more that it's, having been there, that it beautifully and brilliantly captures what it's like when you're at your emotional height during the breakdown of a relationship, and I think it captures that more than the sinister thing. It taps into that brilliantly, you know, because at that point your emotions are, you know, they're feral. You don't know you don't know how you're going to react. The old cliche, you can't eat, you can't sleep. You're living it and breathing it, and it's going round in your mind all the time, and your mind might be playing tricks on you or whatever it is. So that that intensity and the questions that the song is asking, you know, and it's harsh.
Yeah.
But it's fantastic, yeah, it's good. As well.
I hear it as tormented rather than
tormented,
sinister.
Yeah.
I mean, every line is great, but it's the one, you know, it's knowing that he knows you now after only guessing that you think, stabbing yourself in the heart a little bit with that.
Yeah, well, again, you know, brutal. I love that he went there, you know. I love his honesty, that he actually went, I'm going to put this on a record. Because, you know, it's tough for everybody all around, because I do not doubt for one second that these events basically, you know, took place. You know, I might be wrong. Maybe he made it all up. I don't know. But it seems as though you couldn't write. So was, you know, it's visceral. It is tormented.
Yeah. Yeah. And the guitar solo is like perfectly.
it's
demented, isn't it? But perfectly matches what he's saying in the song.
Yeah, it's brilliant. The guitar solo is kind of like, it's an important part of
it.
And they're not even two notes anywhere near the key that the song is in.
No.
And it just adds to it.
You're listening to Dangerous Amusements, a piece of stale bread curling on the luncheon counter of life.
So I Want You, written on a train journey from Liverpool to London, according to Elvis, and then released on Blood and Chocolate in September 86. Just to go forward a little bit to when you first encountered Elvis, was that on the Mersey Boys and Liverpool Girls album?
That's right, yeah. I think it was 2000 or 2001.
2001, I think.
We've got a mutual friend, Steve, who began the museum in Liverpool, you know, in the COP, and he was putting together an album of songs by Liverpool artists throughout the years. I think Mersey Boys and Liverpool Girls was the other way around. Yeah, and it was on EMI, and he'd been to see a couple of our gigs. We'd become mates, and he asked, could he use one of our tracks? And he had a Wings song on there and a Bunnymen song, and he asked, could we use one of ours? I was, absolutely, you know. So that was on, that went on the record, and the great thing was is that he said, I'm gonna do a launch gig, and would you come and play that with your band? I thought, fantastic, yeah, absolutely. He goes, and Elvis is gonna come and do a couple of songs, and I didn't believe that would actually come to pass.
Yeah,
you know, you get told these things if you're in the music industry, you hear of these things all the time, and we got there, and he was there. And it was kind of bizarre. I think he did Timeless Melody by The
Roars. I was going to ask you about that. I'd love to see that.
And the really odd thing was he launched into singing it. He had his acoustic guitar. I think he was waiting to do a little sound check and was stood in the venue. And he launched into singing a verse of it while he was stood next to me. So for the first time ever, I heard his voice acoustically, which had been like a constant companion coming out of the record player for, you know, 20 years previous or whatever. And it was really bizarre to hear that familiar voice actually next to you. And it's exactly the same, obviously, but it was just bizarre not, you know, hearing it in that context. And I'd seen the band. I'd seen Elvis play live a couple of times. So, but actually, you know, being there next to him. And it was funny because he said, I watch one of your songs. He said, but I've got to get off and see me mum. You know, I was like, oh, no problem. You know, it's lovely to meet you. He said, but, you know, I've got to see her while I'm here, you know, because she's getting on. And so, no problem. So we went on stage and it was a great gig. And we turned in a really strong performance. And I could see him at the side of the stage because he's obviously, you know, he's with his glasses, he's a familiar person. And we were getting towards the end of the set and he was still there. And I could tell that he was still there. So I was like, oh, he must have stayed a little bit longer. So we socked it to them a little bit more. Came off stage and he was first person into the dressing room. You know, oh, I loved it. I couldn't leave. Great. You know, yeah, yeah. I really, really enjoyed the set. And it was a lovely feeling for me because, you know, as I explained before, he is where I came in, him and Joe and Paul and the rest of them, you know. And so that was just like a circle being made. And that was it. You know, he said, I've got to run off. And I think about only a few weeks went. And Milo, who used to work for him, who sadly passed away now, wonderful fella, he phoned me up. Said, Elvis wants you to be his backing band live on the telly. Would you think about it?
Would I think about it?
So that was it. That was kind of our... That was the beginning of our professional relationship.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll jump on to that because I know we're going to talk about that song in a few minutes as well, okay. The one that you performed with him. But yeah. Let's just go chronologically into the 90s. And the song that you added to the playlist.
Yeah.
From 96, from All This Useless Beauty.
Yeah.
And The Other End of the Telescope.
I know it don't make a difference to you, but oh, it's all made a difference to me. You see me off in the distance, I hope, at the other end. At the other end of the telescope.
I heard this on the radio only about 2 years ago.
Okay.
So I was unfamiliar with it. And I was just stunned that it was such a brilliantly written song with all of his trademarks, a magnificent melody. And also he often uses unusual words which strike you in the song. Mm. You know, when you first hear the song, it's like, striking use of words, what's going on there? But then you listen, you know, the song then withstands many, many repeated listens because it is unusual, you know. And I think the last verse he's talking about bamboo needle and that's all right.
Late in the evening as I sit here moping with a bamboo needle on a shellac of Chopin and the cast iron heart that you failed to tear open.
Come on, that's fantastic. So, you know, those lines. So I think, if I remember it rightly, I think I wrote to him. I got on to him and said, I've just did one of your songs on the radio here. And he was taken aback that they bothered to play him on the radio these days.
Yeah.
I was going, wow. And again, you know, what I loved about it was the something that I didn't know. And then all of a sudden I found it, played it to death ever since. Yeah. And it just goes to show the depth, you know. It's like a never-ending well of tunes.
Right. Well, that's a bit of a favourite album of mine, actually, All This Useless Beauty, 1996. And obviously the series of songs that a lot of them he'd written for other people and then went back to record them himself. Right, okay. And I love Complicated Shadows on that record. Yeah, it's such a great song.
Yeah.
And this one, Telescope, co-written with Amy Mann, originally released in 88 on the Till Tuesday album, Everything's Different Now. And I'd have to go back and double-check, but I don't think that verse that we mentioned is in the original version. I think I might be wrong here, and someone will tweet me and correct me, but I'm sure that's only in Elvis's version in 96. But that's always been the verse that sticks out at me with the shellac of Chopin. It's such great words.
Oh, it is, yeah. And, you know, and as he'll tell you himself, or any songwriter will tell you, really good melodies are hard to come by. Mm. You know, otherwise they'd be pouring out of all of us. But that is almost like the bit as a songwriter that you have to kind of wait round for or be blessed with. You know, whenever you hear songwriters talking about pulling tunes out of the ether, or they feel as though they are just a conduit for music. That's that thing. And in that particular song, he got one hell of a beautiful melody. You know, as yet, I've never been heard by any human ears before, and then all of a sudden there it is. Mm. Great chorus. And of course, you know, lyrically, as we've said, killer song.
on the playlist, we move into the 2000s, and this is the song that you mentioned a few minutes ago that you backed Elvis up on telly when he was he was promoting When I Was Cruel.
Yeah,
I was going to say another favourite album of mine, but I realised I'm going to end up saying that for a lot of albums as we go through, but genuinely an album that I really love from 2002, reached number 17 in the UK charts, and this track, Tear Off Your Own Head, it's a doll revolution.
Yeah. You can be in his nails, make him wear high heels. When Milo had got in touch, he said Elvis needs a band to back him on the Jonathan Ross television show, and he loved what you did. Would you do it? I went, yeah, of course, absolutely. We'd love to do it. And they sent me the song. It wouldn't have been by email in those days. I got sent it by something physical,
a mini disc or something.
A DAT. Put it on immediately. Digged. It's three chord. Mm. You know, raw. Rock and roll aspect, felt like something I understood intuitively, and it's a very basic song. In I think there's only like three chords in it or something. Got my band together. I learnt the words, so rocked through it, and it was it was a massive honour to be asked to do it, and we wanted to get it right, we really wanted to get it right. So we listened to the song intensely, and there's a bit whereby, if I remember this rightly, there's A's and D's going on, but buried deep in the mix, there's a low keyboard or something, or a bass that plays a C, and it causes a lot of tension within the song, but it's one of those things that you don't hear, you feel. And we had a genius keyboard player then, and he picked up on it. So when we started, we were in a rehearsal room with Elvis. He comes in the room, all kind of nervous. We just bashed through the song once, and as soon as it finished, he turned to the keyboard player, and he goes, you got that bit, the tension. Because it was, we're well within our rights to not get that bit. But the keyboard player really listened. And we bashed through it once. We did it one more time, and he took his guitar and says, that's it. We were like, wow, aren't we going to like tear it apart, and go through everything till we get it absolutely right? And he goes, no, fantastic. Mm. That's all we need. And it was, the whole thing was a thrill, going down. I think the other people on the show that night was Cliff Richard and Carol Smiley were on the show.
And Elvis, was that the same one when, did he play Allison on his own?
Played Allison.
Yeah.
Jonathan Ross said something. If you ever see me in the pub, come and ask me, and I'll tell you what it was, because it was awful, but it was really hilarious. So it was a lovely day, and then it was actually recorded the night before it went out. Mm. So Elvis said, as soon as we'd finished it, it was 10 o'clock at night. He took us all to a restaurant in round the corner in Shepherd's Bush, and he'd put us all in the Hilton as well. We got rotten drunk. He wasn't drinking, and we were in the bar in the Hilton, and we had a brilliant night having a laugh. And I remember that night I asked him, because I've always had this thing when I first got involved in the music industry, whoever I came across, whether it be like an international songwriting legend like Elvis, or the girl who works on the reception in the recording studio, or your agent, or anybody at all, I always have this question, and the question is, who's your hero? And you can't, which band or artist, you can't say, oh, I like them, but also I really like them. You've got to nail your colours to the last one, and you can't say anybody else. And I think I asked him, and I'm sure he said Bob Dylan.
Right,
I'm sure that's what he said, but I was drunk by that point. Anyway, we about 3 o'clock. He stayed with us all night. About 3 o'clock, we had a brilliant time, and he went to leave to go to bed. And I think we all stood up on our. This is 2001, I think. We all stood up on our seats, And as he was leaving, he was singing, Elvis, 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 and which alerted the attention to everybody in the bar that he was there. And he was just like laughing, going, shut up, shut up. So when we all got up in the morning, we all just had our head and our hands in the hotel, just going, well, we won't hear from him again then. Because we've kind of brought it to everybody's attention. But we were having such a good laugh, you know, it was all very high-spirited and it was a lovely time.
I'm really hoping, by the way, that Cliff was stood on a table as well. No. I don't want you to say no and spoil the impression.
No, he was nowhere to be seen. And I was thinking, oh, gee. I remember our John, my cousin, who plays guitar in Amsterdam. He goes, oh, well, he says, I'll go get another job somewhere else. That was, we've blown our one chance. And I got back home and there was a voicemail off him, off Elvis saying, come and be the opening act for our world tour on the opening night in Amsterdam.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello, wow. And I love that.
Yeah,
you know,
perfect.
Amsterdam in Amsterdam.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he obviously loved it as well, and that was brilliant.
Yeah, great. I remember saw him do Tear Off Your Own Head at the first time I ever saw him live, which was around that time as well, in 02, and that was at Mountford Hall.
Oh,
great,
folks.
I think the radio station I was working at the time was promoting it, and we went, and it was great.
Yeah.
So I love the song, love that album as well. Yeah. Obviously, in the 2000s, you duet with Elvis as well around Capital of Culture time, and there's the... Liverpool number ones record, and you cover The Searchers. I was just wondering what was the song choice process? How did you come up with that? How did you come up with the arrangement?
I'd been sort of asked to get involved with it, and they were asking Elvis separately, and then somebody had the bright idea of putting us together because we knew each other, you know, and it was, and then we could record the backing track, and he could, and he chose the song, you know. He has much more familiarity with the Merseybeat era than any of us would. We sidestepped Little Children for obvious reasons at that time, you know. Probably wouldn't have been a wise move. And he chose this song. And I remember listening to it, and it's kind of really chirpy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's jangly early 60s Merseybeat,
really
isn't
chirpy.
It?
Yeah. So we deconstructed it a little bit, and I guess we took a bit of a gamble, because you know we were given the opportunity to release, and again this album was on EMI and all, we're given the opportunity to release a song with Elvis, but we felt it was just way too chirpy for that we could, you know, that would represent us for the original version. It was different times, wasn't it? So I think my cousin R. John, he put a detuned guitar on it when we were kind of jamming it round, and Tony Carey, the producer, slowed it down, and it was them that got the vibe of the recording, and it really, and I think they really got something which is makes it, you know, a really interesting and a good cover version of it. We sent it over to Elvis, and I remember him phoning me up. And he was surrounded by nappies because the lads had just been born, you know.
Yeah.
And he's, we're on the phone, I'm talking about how we're going to do the thing, and he's telling me about it. And he goes, hang on a sec, the phone gets dropped, and he has to go and sort one of the lads out, and comes back. And it was, we glued it all together, you know, and it was a thrill because my voice is in with his voice.
Don't throw your dreams away.
But the atmosphere that we created in that track, you know, juxtaposed to the original version, the lads in my band did a good bit of work.
It's a good track, isn't it?
You know what I mean? It's a good recording, and suits where I come from musically, and I dare say, you know, him as well. You know, he doesn't tend to do like chirpy music, so. So it was good, you know. I stand by that as a decent piece of work. It could have been so easily gone the wrong way.
Yeah. Cool. I know time is pressing, so let's just move on to the last song that you've added to our playlist. This from anything from 2010 onwards. You went from the album Look Now, yeah. October 2018. Haven't you tired of that darkness yet? Didn't you cry your heart out? It's only a dream. What is it about love you can't accept? Mr. and Mrs. Hush.
Yeah, could have been a few off this record. To make a full circle, I remember when I got the album, immediately took to it. You know, I thought, God, these are bloody strong songs, you know. Mm. I think I wrote to him about it and said, all of his, you know, his peers, his contemporaries, none of them can write a record as... Mm. As strong as this, in my opinion, who are still bothering to make music for that and that alone. I was like, oh wow, you know. And the thing that I love most about it all is, I get to learn something.
Yeah,
I get to go, okay, that's how you do that. Mm-hmm. Watching I Want You from the side of the stage in Amsterdam in the Paradiso, mm-hmm. watching the way that he played that song to the audience was like being in class for me, because it was the first time I'd ever seen anybody stand off from the mic, you know what I mean? I thought, oh my God, everybody, I learned a valuable lesson that to get people to be quiet, you don't play louder over them, you actually go quieter.
Play quieter, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And I went, wow. You know, and this is like an instruction in how the master does it. So I love that, you know. And again, with Look Now, how do you do it at this point in this? And Mr. and Mrs. Hush has that great production technique whereby you think you're just listening to the song and all of a sudden a button gets pressed, mm-hmm. and the full production blooms into
you. It does.
The thing. And again, I was like, how, you know, I played it to our producer, how did they do this? This is amazing. And the track as well, you know, what a song.
I love
the call and response.
I was going to say, I think the backing vocal arrangements are some of the best that he's got.
Brilliant.
In fact, actually, that whole album, and you were talking about the show at the Olympia and the backing singers,
yeah.
I thought that they brought so much to the newer songs at that gig, didn't they? Unwanted Number.
Unwanted Numbers, an absolute classic.
Did It Burn Sugar Is So Bitter at that gig as well, and just that they made it so good.
I think so. I think, you know, there's a run of six or seven songs on that album, which are absolute belters.
Yeah, yes.
And that's hard to do. It's bloody hard to do. You know, people don't realise it's... If you sit down and go, right, I'm gonna write, you know, this, it doesn't work out like that. Mm-hmm. They have to be God-given, you know, in a non-religious way. It has to... You know, you have to be anointed with them, I feel, good songs, you know. So, yeah.
Final word on Mr. and Mrs. Hush. I just dug out Rolling Stone's article about it.
Okay.
They described it as a punchy soul kiss tune with funky swagger.
Yeah, oh,
that's
yeah.
Put that
no,
on
it
the
is.
Poster.
And the call and response and that, like the black male vocals that are going on. And again, you know, and it all hangs on his vocal delivery, which is second to none. And it's kind of, he does something there which he's never done before. That's important as well, you know. Mm-hmm. There's no point in going over old ground as a songwriter or how your records sound. And I've never heard him do, you know, a record quite like that before. Mm. So, fair play.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Ian, it's been great chatting to you.
No,
thanks
thank you very much
for doing this. And good luck with the recordings and look forward to hearing those when they come out. And I should say, for the record, of all the times that I've rented a hotel room by the hour, this has been one of the most enjoyable, mate, so thank you.
People will be talking about us, mate.
Cheers, Ian.
No problem.
Thank you to the brilliant Ian Prowse. He's on Twitter, @IanProwse. His website is amsterdam-music.com. The theme music for our podcast is performed by Gary Mulcahy. The playlist put together by our guests is on Spotify. Look for Dangerous Amusements. And that's our name on social media as well. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
You've been listening to Dangerous Amusements. Now go and hurl yourself into heaven before the gates close.